To BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is Friday, August 24th, 2012, and this is podcast number 194. Yesterday, I had halfway planned to divide the podcast into two parts, and then when I got in about halfway into the podcast, I decided, yes, definitely I will divide this podcast into two parts. And then I got down to about the last 10 minutes, and I thought, you know what? I'm just going to cram it all together. And so I kind of left some things dangling, and I kind of left some things unsaid that I should have clarified. So in a sense, today is Mimics in the Garden of Liberty Part 2, but really it's not. I'm just going to clarify a couple things and refer back to it. There are aspects of today's podcast that will be more clear and easier to understand if you've heard yesterday's podcast. But that's kind of true with all of my podcasts, in a sense. I was thinking about a title for today, and I thought, well, I'm going to be referring to yesterday's podcast, Mimics in the Garden of Liberty. So do I call this Mimics in the Garden of Liberty Part 2? And then after I got the notes all done and everything all worked out, I thought, no. Here's what I'm going to call this as a working title. I'm going to call it Loki Dancing in the Garden of Liberty. And if you're not sure who Loki is, let's just work through this and you'll see who I'm accusing of being Loki Dancing in the Garden of Liberty. First off, I want to clarify what I was talking about in yesterday's podcast. And I want to go back to the difference in kind and difference in degree. Now, if you recall, I can't remember when, it was like a week or two ago, I did a podcast called Difference in Kind and Difference in Degree. And this is really important when you're having a discussion, especially if it's a logic-based discussion, not just wild emotions. You know, you're on the internet talking to somebody and they're like, you know, what? You don't like peanut butter? You're worse than Hitler. Well, okay, you know, that's absurdity. But on the other hand, when you say the police state in America is moving in the exact same path, exact same patterns, exact same formulation as Nazi Germany was in the 1930s. Now what we're talking about here, when you're saying you don't like peanut butter, therefore you're a Nazi or you're worse than Hitler, well, see, that's a difference in kind. There's no comparison there. It's two different things altogether. But when you say the police state in America is moving in the exact same direction with the exact same structure, the same, everything is the same as it was in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, that's the same thing in kind. It's just a difference in degree. And if you take the police state in the United States and you just think forward, and you look at what has happened since the formation of the police state in America, and that's really in the late 1800s, uniformed police began, I did a whole other podcast, a series on this, but uniformed police began in the United States in the 1870s as the gangs in New York and in Boston and Philadelphia and Chicago, as they converted into the police, they began to take on uniforms. And this was specifically because of their experiences during during Lincoln's War. During Lincoln's War, these same individuals fought in the war and came out and realized how important it was that their gangs be uniformed. And this is how we had, this is how we came to adopt uniformed police in the U.S. In Great Britain, it was different. When Robert Peel first introduced police the concept of police into Ireland to control the Irish population, they were uniformed right from the beginning. And so later when he introduced them into England and into specifically into London, he maintained that as a paramilitary force, having that image of uniformed police. So the birth of those, and this is not the topic of today's podcast, by the way, but the birth of those police, first to suppress the Irish and later to suppress the English in their own country, that was a paramilitary group to begin with. But in the U.S., it was different. In the U.S., it was a movement from gangs to police, and they didn't adapt uniforms until after Lincoln's War, and then uniforms became a standard part of police. The police were no longer gang-based, and they became a paramilitary organization. Now going from that point in 1870s until today in 2012, then it's entirely legitimate to say this is the same exact pattern as we saw in Nazi Germany in the 1930s, because we're talking about the same thing in like, it's just a difference in degree. So that is an entirely legitimate thing. Now, if we take this and we compare it to, you know, what I was talking about with mimics. Now, think of the difference in kind and think of the difference in degree. In your garden, you might grow carrots. And a weed that might crop up, especially here where I live in Ohio, they're everywhere, but it's also true, I think, in a lot of the places east of the Mississippi. There's a weed called Queen Anne's lace. And Queen Anne's lace is not necessarily a mimic, although, oddly enough, there's a mimic of Queen Anne's lace that's poisonous. But that's a different topic altogether. So, but in the garden, you can have carrots, and you can have a weed that comes into your garden called Queen Anne's lace. Now, most people don't realize it, but Queen Anne's lace is just a wild carrot. Queen Anne's lace was actually brought to the U.S. among the early English settlers as a food source, and it got out of control and got out of their gardens, and is slowly spreading. Baggy is now getting ready to stomp on my keyboard. Baggy, for all the new listeners, Baggy is the cat here at badquaker.com. Anyway, she was merciful and didn't attack the mic that time. Anyway, back to the topic. So in your garden, you might be intentionally growing carrots, and at the same time, Queen Anne's lace may be attempting to invade your garden. But what we have here is the same kind. It's same in kind. It's difference in degree. A Queen Anne's lace weed is a carrot. It doesn't resemble a carrot. The top doesn't look like a carrot. The root doesn't look like a carrot. But they are. They're the same thing. They're same in kind, just different in degree. Now, yesterday when I was talking about the Hoover Institution, we're talking about different in kind there. When you think about people like John Yoo and Paul E. Peterson, and remember I read from them and I quoted them and I talked about those two guys. I specifically named them, the torturer John Yoo and the right-wing nut, Paul E. Peterson. What we have there is a difference in kind to us, to people in the liberty movement, to people libertarian-oriented. It's a difference in kind. They are an entirely different beast than we are. Now, this is different with the Hoover Institution. Then we move over. I was picking on Downsize DC. But if you recall, and if you go back and listen, if you're not sure, go back and listen to me yesterday. I didn't name names yesterday. And there's a reason I didn't name names at Downsize DC. The reason why is because actually Downsize DC is not different from us in kind. It's different from us in degree. You see, they're making horrible mistakes at Downsize DC. But you don't see somebody like John Yoo over there telling people that it's okay to torture people. You see the difference? So we have people among us who are like us, who are part of us, but who have a directional flaw, who have accepted something. Somehow there's a mistake in some aspect of their message. And because of that, they are same as us in kind, but there's a difference in degree. Now, anybody who knows anything about, like, geometry, if you think about geometry, think about a line. And a line goes from one point to another point. And let's say this goes across your paper from the right side to the left side of your paper. There's a point on the right side of your paper, there's a point on the left side of your paper, and a line goes directly from one point to the other point. Okay, we think of this in geometry. This is our little geometry lesson at badquaker.com for today. If you have a line that goes from a point on your right-hand side to a point on your left-hand side, and you change the degree just slightly, then the line will miss its point of arrival. It will not go from the point on the right-hand side to the point on the left-hand side if you just change the degree slightly. And the further distance apart those two points are, the greater the miss will be when the line goes on its way towards, you know, towards its destination. So difference in degree in this sense, if you're on a path, let's say you're going from New York and you're trying to go in a straight line, you're in an airplane and you're trying to fly as straight line as possible to Los Angeles. If you're off just a few degrees, you don't end up in Los Angeles. You might end up in Guadalajara, Mexico, or you might end up in Seattle, Washington, or you might end up anywhere. But you're not going to be in Los Angeles if you're off only the slightest degree. Well, this is the same with truth. You can be kind of hitting the right path. You can be kind of on the right way, but if your degrees are slightly off, then where you're really going is not where you think you're going. And that's the situation with organizations like Downsize DC, because they've got a fundamental flaw in their thinking, in the path that they're taking. They are missing the point by small degrees. And those small degrees over a further distance of time make a much more dramatic difference in where they're actually headed and where they think they're headed. So this is drastically different from what we're thinking about with the Hoover Institution. With the Hoover Institution, you know, they're starting out at an evil point, of a point of domination, a point of lying and using deceptive words to make themselves appear to be something they're not. But that's not the case with organizations like, let's say, Downsize DC, because I was picking on them yesterday. But now, let's take it in a different direction. Let's think of the Cato Institute. What about the Cato Institute? Well, are they a difference in like? I'm sorry, are they a difference in kind or a difference in degree? Well, that's yet to be determined. But I think of the Cato Institute as sort of Murray Rothbard's misconceived accident of lust. And if you're not sure what I'm talking about with that, the origin of the Cato Institute was Murray Rothbard attempting to use the political processes and attempting to use the vast fortunes of the radical right-wing Republican Koch family. So it was literally Murray's accident of lust that conceived the Cato Institute. And it's kind of like, you know, there's so many stories in mythology about an accidental, you know, moment of lust that creates a monster. We could get into several myths in that, but that's how I see the Cato Institute. That's completely different from Downsize DC. So we'll call it to be determined if it's difference in degree or difference in kind. Now, this brings me to a different position altogether. And if you're a longtime listener, you've maybe heard some of this before, but maybe I'm going to bring it about in a slightly different way. I was listening to Bob Wenzel, and Bob Wenzel was interviewing Walter Block. Oh boy. Now, where does Walter Block fall in this? Is Walter Block difference in kind, difference in degree? No, he's the same as us. He's right there with us. Difference in degree. Well, I don't know. What I'm wondering is if he has a grasp on reality. When I was listening to this, between Bob Wenzel and Walter Block, I got done and my wife said, she says to me, am I going to have to put a ban on who you can and can't listen to? It just affected me so much listening to Walter Block and listening to his, my goodness. It was like watching Loki dancing in the Garden of Liberty. It really was. It was like, who are you now, Loki? What are you doing now, Loki? What kind of trick are you going to play now, Loki? Oh, my goodness, Loki, what are you doing this for? Oh, no, not again, Loki. Come on, Walter, what are you doing to us? Okay, when I come back from the break, I'm going to talk a little bit about Walter Block and his interview with Bob Wenzel. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break there. Now, at this point, it's important for me to give my Ron Paul disclaimer. In the rare instance that somebody gets this podcast into Walter Block's hands, in the rare instance that he may actually listen to this, it's not very likely, but he probably won't make it in this far. So because of that, it's unlikely that even if Walter Block were to somehow be given or bump into this podcast in some way, it's unlikely he'll make it to this point to hear this disclaimer. So this is mostly, I suppose, aimed at people who actually are Ron Paul supporters or people who are, you know, supporters of Walter Block in some way or whatever. But let me just say this about Ron Paul. First off, and I say this all the time, I was voting for Ron Paul before most of Ron Paul's supporters were even alive. That's all the way back in 1988. I liked Ron Paul back then. I liked Ron Paul in the years afterwards. I read his stuff. I kind of followed along at a distance on what he was doing. I was very thrilled in 2006 when he started talking about the possibility of coming back into the race for presidency. I supported Ron Paul in 2008. But even today, I like the vast majority of what Ron Paul has to say. I've just come to a position where I understand that attempting to use the government to change the government is the height of folly. Attempting to use the government to change the government is immoral. It is both immoral and impractical. I've come to the position where I understand that that is the truth. Now, once I came to that position, that doesn't mean I don't like Ron Paul. That doesn't mean I disagree with Ron Paul. That doesn't mean I'm attacking Ron Paul. I'm not doing any of those things. So if by some weird chance Walter Block ever gets a hold of any of my podcasts and he accuses me of attacking Ron Paul the way he has accused Stefan Molyneux and, Wendy McElroy and others, the way he's accused them of, his words, attacking Ron Paul. Well, I've never attacked Ron Paul, and I appreciate Ron Paul. It's just that I've come to a point of where I realize that it's immoral and impractical to use government to change government. And as long as that's Ron Paul's goal, then Ron Paul is wrong. And people who support Ron Paul, if that's their goal, then they're wrong. Now, there are people who support Ron Paul because his message is getting out. That's great. That's fine. But I don't. Because part of his message is to use government to fix government. And that's wrong. And I have made that argument over and over, and I'm not going to make it here. But anyway, now let's get back to my notes here. So that's my Ron Paul disclaimer. I am not attacking Ron Paul. I'm just saying that there are methods that are effective and there are methods that are ineffective. And typically speaking, moral methods are more effective than immoral methods. So keeping that in mind, I seek the moral method. And that excludes the possibility of voting for Ron Paul or anyone else. Now, Block, in this interview with Bob Wenzel, Walter Block says an interesting thing. He says that he, and this is quotes, all right? He said this. It's his word. Block said that he supported Obama over McCain. Now, that's his word, supported Obama over McCain. And again, his word, he favors Obama over Romney. That is a direct quote from the interview with Bob Wenzel. He favors Obama over Romney. Now, I have to say that there's no basis in logic for this. This is purely a politically based position. How can you possibly say that you can favor or support one of these clowns over the other and still be a disciplined libertarian? He claims to be an anarchist. He claims to be an anarcho-capitalist. How can Walter Block position himself as a libertarian or an anarcho-capitalist or an anarchist and take this purely political position of supporting Obama over McCain and favoring Obama over Romney? How can he do that? I don't know. I think there's a disconnect somewhere that allows him to take that position. But I'm not sure about actually pointing out what that disconnect might be. Now I'm going to quote here, and I thought about playing the audio, but unfortunately Bob Wenzel's site embeds the audio into a video, and it's very difficult. You can't just, right click and download it as an MP3 and then cut out the piece that you want. I'm not sure who's doing their formatting over there, but it's really kind of goofy. So it's difficult to handle. It's difficult to cut a chunk of it out. I mean, I probably could have sat down and re-recorded I just didn't have time for it. So here's what I did. I sat down and meticulously listened to what Block was saying and typed it out word for word, and I'm going to read it for you right now. These are exactly Walter Block's words, and I went over and over this to make sure I wasn't making a mistake. So this is this is Walter Block's words. The Republican Party is a magnificent vehicle for promoting libertarianism, as shown by the evidence that when Ron Paul ran, and then at this point, Walter Block kind of goes into gobbledygook because he can't remember when Ron Paul ran for president. Well, Walter, he ran in 1988. Okay, so we'll get back to the thing. So, shown by the evidence that when Ron Paul ran as libertarian in 88, he made no inroads whatsoever, whereas in 2008 and in 2012, even more so, he's made magnificent contributions to libertarianism. I think Ron Paul has converted more people to libertarianism by his using the Republican Party as a vehicle than pretty much anyone else, with the possible exception of Ayn Rand. Even though she wasn't a libertarian, she was an objectionist. Anyway, going back to the quote, Ron Paul has used the GOP as a vehicle, as a means to promote liberty, and ingratiating himself in the GOP would quiet some of the vicious attacks on him, maybe. So there is the other side. And then he goes on to say, after a little while, he says, it's not a matter of principle, but it's a matter of pragmatism. And then much later he goes on to say, the only way we're going to win is to convert the masses to libertarianism. Now, just think about this for a second. He says that Ron Paul's used the GOP as a vehicle, as a means to promote liberty and ingratiating himself in the GOP. And this would quiet the vicious attacks on him. And that it's not a matter of principle, it's a matter of pragmatism. And that we're only going to win by converting the masses to libertarianism. Ingratiating means to gain approval or favor. Do we really want to gain approval or favor with the GOP? Is that actually a goal? Is that something we should strive for? I can't help but to think that this is pure fantasy on the part of Walter Block. I'm wondering if it's delusional thinking. It's detached from reality that the GOP, that the actual inner structure of this horrible organization could ever embrace the message of liberty. Because the message of liberty, the real message of libertarianism, is the exact opposite of what either of the two parties stand for. It's the exact opposite. The every aspect of republicanism and democracy is based on socialism. Hans Hermann Hoppe has shown this. I don't have to go into all that. I've gone through it myself over and over and over. Why in the world would the internal workings of the GOP ever embrace the concepts of libertarianism when the concepts of libertarianism is to kill the GOP, is to cause the ceasing of its existence? Why would they do that? That would be like the Federal Reserve all of a sudden realizing that that fractional reserve banking is bad, and it would adopt honest banking. Why would it do that? It's got this perfect scam going right now, and if it adopted honest banking, it would kill itself. That's illogical. It's backwards thinking. It's fantasy. It's borderline delusional. Now, the other thing he said is, it's not a matter of principles. It's a matter of pragmatism. Well, okay. Now, one of the things Walter Block likes to do, and he even mentioned this in the interview with Wenzel, and it's a tool that all of us in the liberty movement tend to use, and it's a good tool. You know, Rothbard used it, Mises used it, Hayek used it. And to use this tool is to take something to its logical end. Okay, so now, if it's not a matter of principles, and it is a matter of pragmatism, then let's compare this to something else. If we can use pragmatism to accomplish a goal and set principles aside, then how about if we do that to, say, you know, make money, to get wealthy? Okay, so then we can just rob a bank, and our end, our goal, is to get money. Well, that's fine. We can just rob, as long as we can pull it off and get away with it, we can just rob a bank because we've set aside our principle, and we're only going after pragmatism. Well, let me be just brutally honest with you here. A lot of bank robberies fail because a lot of bank robbers are idiots. But the vast majority of bank robberies are successful because professional bank robbers know how to go in, rob a bank, and get away, and they do so in a professional manner, and they never get caught. The vast majority of bank robbers never get caught because it's really not that hard. The fact that banks aren't robbed all the time is based on the principles of citizens. It's not based on the pragmatism of how hard it is to rob a bank. So if we take Walter Block's position out to its furthest extent, we should go rob banks. Isn't that right, Walter? If you're setting aside your principles in order to achieve a goal, then why shouldn't we rob banks, Walter? Now, a principle is a fundamental truth or proposition that serves as the foundation for a system of belief or behavior, or for a chain of reasoning. It's a rule or belief that governs one's personal behavior. If your personal behavior is governed by principles, then you will do the right thing. But if you are only goal-oriented, you will have and without principle, you will have a tendency not to do the right thing. And the trick there is, the really fun part of being principled, the fun part of having principles is that the tendency in human nature, when we follow proper principles like the zero aggression principle and so forth, when we follow principles and we behave in a correct manner, according to natural law, when we do that, ultimately it works out better than it does for people who throw their morals and their principles aside. You see, moral behavior produces good. Principled behavior produces good. Unprincipled behavior, in the long run, in the short term, it may produce what feels like good or what seems like good. But in the long run, principled behavior produces more good, a more net gain of good, than does unprincipled behavior or immoral behavior. This is, you can see this in the basic understanding that two wrongs don't make a right. You can't make a right by doing wrong over and over and over. It doesn't matter how many times you do wrong, you're not going to produce a net gain of right. Because the only way you can produce right is by doing right. So it is a matter of principle, Walter. It is a matter of principle. If we want to accomplish freedom, if we want to accomplish a condition of liberty, we cannot take on immoral actions as being acceptable. We cannot take that which is evil and call it good in order to obtain the ends that we want, because we won't obtain the ends that we're going for. We will obtain the exact opposite of what we want. We will get more oppression. We'll just be the oppressors. Now, for him to say that Ron Paul made no inroads in 1988 compared to 2008 and 2012, you have to understand, what was there a market for in 1988? Well, let's step back to 1988. This was the end of the Reagan era. Ronald Reagan had revitalized the Republican Party. He had spouted a lot of libertarian concepts and a lot of libertarian words, and he had drawn a lot of liberty-loving people in to support him. And then, of course, he acted like every other Republican once he got in there. But the real market in 1988, and the market that the Republican administration really played on, was the fear of the Soviet Union. They were the evil empire. Reagan constantly told America how dangerous the Soviet Union was and how they were out to get us and they were a horrible monster. They were the evil empire, and there was, you know, comparisons to Star Wars and all these other things were going on. So at the time, there was a market in fear and there was a market in security from the evil empire. And the Republicans played on that all the way through the 1980s. And well into 1988. So here's Ron Paul with a message of peace and liberty when the market was desiring fear and security. So Ron Paul was trying to sell something the market didn't want in 1988. Now you fast forward that to 2008. George W. Bush, who had been in control for 8 years, George W. Bush was no Ronald Reagan. He did not have the savvy. He did not have the smooth appeal. He did not have the intelligence. Frankly, he did not have the intelligence. And he was not able to pull off the same selling of a market in security and fear. He did not have an evil empire to demonize and scare Americans with. All he had was a made-up story of a guy off in a cave somewhere in Afghanistan, or maybe a bad guy in Iraq. That's all he had. And many Americans saw through the veil. Lots of Americans saw through this imagined threat. And so in 2008, under the thumb of the oppression of government like Americans had never suffered before in their history, Americans were crying out for liberty. There was a market for liberty in 2008. There was not that market for liberty in 1988. There was a market for fear and security. So when there's a market for liberty, it doesn't matter if Ron Paul's given the message or Daffy Duck. There's a market for it. Who cares who the salesman is? When I go to the store, I go to the store to buy something. Let's say I'm going to go buy a new laptop. I'm not going to walk into the store and buy a Chevrolet. I'm looking for a laptop. I don't care how good the salesman is. I want a laptop. You're not going to sell me a car, because there's not a market for the car in my desires. There's a market for a laptop. You see, in 1988, Ronald Reagan had control of that market, and he sold America on the fears of the evil empire. But in 2008... George W. Bush was incompetent to do that, and he did not have the luxury of having an evil empire to scare America with. So he was trying to sell a car, but America wanted a laptop. And it just so happened that Ron Paul had been trying to sell that laptop since the 70s. Do you see what I'm saying? Ron Paul's message never changed. Nothing about Ron Paul changed. Why is it that nobody wanted to buy what he was selling back in 1980? In 85, in 88, in 90, in 92. In 92, when Ron Paul's whole campaign was in the process of falling apart, when everything Ron Paul had relied upon was beginning to sag and fall away. Nobody wanted to hear Ron Paul's message of liberty. I was around in the early 90s when libertarian ideas were shrinking, and the whole libertarian, everything that we had, all of the enjoyment that we had had in right around the early Clinton years was starting to fall apart. And we were losing ground. But Ron Paul's message was exactly the same then as it was in 2008. So it's not the man. It's not Ron Paul the man. And it's not even the message. It's what does the market want? And when the market wants a great leader that gives them security from an evil empire, then that's what the market's going to get. And if the market wants a George W. Bush bumbling around wearing his cowboy hat, pretending like there's a monster hiding in the hills of in the mountains of Afghanistan, if the market wants that, they're going to get that. But if the market wants liberty, there's no George W. Bush, there's no Ronald Reagan, and there's no Ron Paul that's going to stop it. And that's the difference. That's what Walter Block has failed to grasp. You see, Walter Block has abandoned, or else he has failed to grasp in the first place, the fundamental teachings of the giants upon whose shoulders we all stand today. People like Herbert Spencer and people like Frank Charteroff and people like Murray Rothbard, who was a friend of Walter Block's, Walter Block has either abandoned their positions or he's failed to understand those positions. I've done a series on the great man and the great man theory. And I'm actually just going to blow right through the commercial here and continue on this, because this is important for me to get through this. There's a lot of misunderstanding about the great man theory, and I'll use Babe Ruth as an example. Babe Ruth was a fantastic baseball player. He was talented in more ways than most baseball fans appreciate today. But he wasn't the president. He wasn't in charge of the government. Okay, so when you say he was a great baseball player, that's, yes, he was. He revolutionized the game. Yes, he did. He did all those things. But the great man theory is not about a good sports figure. The great man theory is about people, this theory that people are planted on earth, generally it's believed by the hand of God or something else like that, and they change history. Like Napoleon or like Caesar or whatever. Now, Herbert Spencer put a lot of effort into just shattering this idea of the great man theory. And this is what Walter Block has failed to grasp or abandon altogether. Ron Paul is not a great man sent by God to change history. Ron Paul is a man, a human being, just like all the rest of us. And he has these ideas, and many of them are good, and some of them are wrong. And he happens to be the salesman selling the laptop on the day that somebody wants to buy the laptop. And that's the only thing that Ron Paul is. He is not magic. He is not sent by the hand of God. He is not here to change history. He is just a man. He is just a human being, and he's nothing more. And to deify him is to jump away from logic in every fashion, and to just build a new state, a new God, based on him. That's all it is. And again, that's not an attack on Ron Paul. That's not saying anything bad about Ron Paul. That's not saying that I dislike Ron Paul. That's not attacking Ron Paul. That's saying that if you deify any human being, you are setting yourself up for disaster. You are setting yourself up to glorify the state, because that's the ultimate end of this. Take it to its ultimate end. If Ron Paul is sent to us by God to change history, then we should deify him. We should make him emperor of the world. We should rally the troops around him and fight the opponents of liberty, right? But then we become the state, don't we? Let me give you a few quotes here. I was just talking about Herbert Spencer, and I'm not going to go into a whole thing again about the great man theory. But let me take it to a different direction. I mentioned Frank Charteroff a second ago, and I think Walter Block could learn a little bit if he'd just go back and refresh himself with Frank Charteroff's wise words. So here's some quotes by Frank Charteroff. A people can vote themselves into slavery, though they cannot vote themselves out of it. Never has the vote been used to abolish privilege it has always been used to demand new ones or to effect a change in the beneficiaries. Now, Block would likely agree with Charteroff on these things, but Block fails to learn the lesson that Charteroff teaches us. Here's another Charteroff quote. You cannot teach anybody anything that he does not, in a real sense, already know. Now, think about that for a minute. Neither education, background, nor income can explain either the socialist or the libertarian. Whenever you try any of these criteria, you're faced with cases that refute your premise. You find that both types come from penthouses and slums. They include PhDs and illiterates. You're driven to the conclusion that if there is a causative principle, it must be found somewhere in the makeup of the person rather than the environmental influences. And here's another one. There are many who are instinctively repelled by government intervention, but who crave intellectual support for their inclinations. It is to them that the proponent of libertarianism must address himself. The socialist is beyond redemption. Now hear this part. That is to say, the libertarian teaches not to make libertarians, but to find them. I'm going to read that again from Frank Charteroff. That is to say, the libertarian teaches not to make libertarians, but to find them. Again, he said, you cannot teach anybody anything that he does not, in a real sense, already know. Now, let me tell you the secret to convert. You know, and Walter Block, over and over in this interview, keeps saying that we need to convert people to libertarian. We have to convert the masses to libertarianism. We have to convert people to libertarianism. Find the best way to convert people to... Well, learn from Frank Charteroff. You cannot convert someone to libertarianism. The only thing you can do is reach into that person's heart and touch something that that person already knows is true. That's the only thing you can do. You can reach into their mind and you can point out something that they already know is evil. You can touch something inside them that they already know is true. But you cannot convert them. It is impossible to convert them. Now, somehow Walter Block nurtures this fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of the state. It reminds me of a Murray Rothbard situation where he was questioning David Friedman, and his premise was, do you hate the state? And I did an article dealing with Walter Block using Murray Rothbard's questioning of David Friedman's whether or not he hated the state. Rothbard said, there runs through For a New Liberty, that's Rothbard's book, there runs through For a New Liberty and most of the rest of my work as well, a deep and pervasive hatred of the state and all of its works based on the conviction that the state is the enemy of mankind. In contrast, it's evident that David, he's talking about David Friedman, in contrast, it's evident that David does not hate the state at all, that he has merely arrived at the conviction that anarchism and competing private police forces are a better social and economic system than any other alternative, or more fully, that anarchism would be better than laissez-faire, which in turn is better than the current system. Amidst the entire spectrum of political alternatives, David Friedman has decided that anarcho-capitalism is superior, but superior to an existing political structure that's pretty good already. In short, there is no sign that David Friedman in any sense hates the existing American state or any state per se, hates it deeply in his belly as a predatory gang of robbers, enslavers, and murderers. No, there is simply the cool conviction that anarchism would be best of all possible worlds, but that our current setup is pretty far up there in desirability. For there is no sense in Friedman that the state, any state, is a predatory gang of criminals. And I could just take out David Friedman's name there and put Walter Block's, and let the words of Rothbard, Walter Block's old friend, ring in his ears. About two-thirds of the way into the interview, Walter Block goes back to attacking several libertarians that have failed to worship at the altar of the great man, Ron Paul, and he calls it unforgivable. Remember Block's words from back, I guess it was a couple years ago. This is Walter Block's words. Is Wendy McElroy still libertarian? No, she opposes the Ron Paul candidacy. You see, it's just a blanket litmus test. Not, do you support Ron Paul's message? Do you support what Ron Paul supports? Do you believe in the things Ron Paul believes in? Not that. It's his candidacy. That's the thing for Walter Block that's the litmus test. Are you a statist and you embrace the concept that you can go into the government and change the government but from inside the government? If not, according to Walter Block, you're not a libertarian. Well, that's the opposite of a libertarian. Again, where is this coming from? Is this an intentional lying and twisting? Is it just a laziness and a failure to go and find out the facts? Or is it a delusional, I don't know. But then he goes on in the interview and starts talking about Thomas Sowell from over at the Hoover Institute. And he actually paints him in a better light than Wendy McElroy. Sowell is currently the Rose and Milton Friedman Senior Fellow on Public Policy at the Hoover Institution. And he paints him in a better light than Wendy. And then he projects ahead, and you know, Bob asks him, like a lot of us ask the people we're interviewing, what do you think of the future? Where do you think the future is taking the movement and thing? And Walter Block's only hope for the future is Ron Paul in 2016. This is delusional, folks. This is absolutely delusional to fall back on this again. Walter Block has failed to learn the lesson of Cato, which was Rothbard's misconceived accident of lust. Getting involved in a lustful relationship with the enemy cannot produce a wonderful, happy child. It can only produce a hideous monster. Keep this in mind. Ron Paul constantly calls himself a conservative. Every time he goes on Fox News, every time he goes on CNN, every time he goes on MSNBC, he calls himself a conservative. But Frank Chodorov once said, "I will punch anyone who calls me a conservative right in the nose." Do you see the difference there? Again, I'm not attacking Ron Paul. I'm saying that we are not conservatives. Conservatives are the exact opposite of what should be desirable among us. When Ron Paul adopts the position of a conservative, he's mistaken. Now, that doesn't mean Ron Paul, going back to what I was talking about earlier, that doesn't mean Ron Paul is a difference in kind from libertarians. He is one of us and we are with him. But there's a difference in degree. And that difference in degree, when projected out on the path of where we're going, where we've been, where we're headed, takes you in the wrong direction to the wrong location. It takes you towards more statism, more government control, a leaner, meaner, stronger, more efficient government. Do you really want a government who is streamlined, who works efficiently, who does all the things that governments do, and balances its books at the same time? Is that really what you want? Is that really your goal? If that is your goal, then it's a difference in kind that we're talking about. Because that is statism. That's what every statist wants. Every liberal, every conservative, every Republican, every Democrat, every dictator, every communist, every socialist, they want that. They want a well-functioning government that efficiently controls the people and accomplishes what it wants to accomplish. This is exactly what Stalin wanted. This is exactly what Lenin wanted. This is exactly what Marx foresaw. This is what they all want. They all want a government that runs lean and clean and efficient. They all want that. That is statism in its purest form. And if that's really what Walter Block wants, if that's really what Ron Paul wants, or if that's really what anybody else wants, downsize DC, Cato, the Hoover Institution, John Yoo, if that's really their goal, then their goal is statism. So you have to ask yourself, is it a difference in kind, or is it a difference in degree? Now, let me not leave you just hanging on this. Let me just say one other thing, and then I'll wrap this up. Keep in mind what I was talking about there, that when you go in shopping for a laptop, there is no possible way to convince you to buy a Chevy. Because the market is for a laptop. That's what you're there to purchase. You want a laptop. You need a laptop. A Chevy will not accomplish what you want. It will not fill the need. And this is the way with liberty. When there is a desire for liberty, liberty will be achieved, and nothing can stop it. When there is a desire in the market for anything, the market supplies that. Someone, somehow, a mechanism in the market will supply it. And then nothing can hold that back. So what can create a market for liberty? Well, let's think about air. This is the thing I always talk about. Let's think about air. When you're walking around day to day, there's no market for air. Air is not a commodity, because the only way something can become a commodity is if it has a rarity. If there's some restriction on how much there is or how hard it is to get a hold of, then it becomes a commodity. So as long as we're walking around in our day-to-day life, there's no desire for air. It's not a commodity. There's no limit to it. But once you don't have air, for whatever reason, if you don't have air, then air becomes precious. Air becomes a commodity that you can't live without. And you will move heaven and earth to get air. You will do whatever you have to do to try to get air, if you can't get air. And that's the same way with anything else in the market, any other desire, anything, including liberty. When it comes to the point of where we recognize human beings, all of us, there is no need to try to convert the masses. It's foolishness to try to convert the masses to libertarianism. You cannot convert anyone to libertarianism. It can't be done. It's an impossibility. But when the desire for liberty becomes so great that the market demands it, there will be liberty. And how can that be? Well, the state strangles liberty. The state strangles us. The state restricts liberty. The state fights liberty. The existence of the state is the opposite of liberty. So when the state gets to the point of where it becomes obvious to everyone what it is, and it becomes obvious to everyone that the state is the opposite condition of liberty, and as we get choked to a certain point, we will throw off the state and we will have liberty. There won't be a conversion. There will be a desire in the market. And when there's a desire in the market, there is no force that can stop it. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you very much for listening.